Lights Your Friday listeners, we're back here, still at Heli Expo, still talking to Doug. We're going to listen to the second half of this episode right now. You don't want to miss it. It is fantastic.
Let's do it.
Let's go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we still have Aaron Bean in the aircraft, yeah, right? And so I say, Aaron, if we put you in the basket and put you down on the deck, can you get, you know, start getting these people moving there? He's like, yeah, yes, sir. So we put him in the basket, you know, like, we don't give him time to dress out. He's been sort of in radio operator mode all day, right? So yeah, we don't give him time to get his TriStar on or anything. He jumps in the basket. We put him down on the deck, sure, and he gets out. Within about 3 seconds, whoa, of him getting in the out of the basket, I hear survivors in the basket. Basket's coming off the,
yeah,
deck. And he got down.
He kicked some ass down there.
I wish I could have seen it. You know, it's all happening below me. I can't see any, yeah, of this, right? But I'm, you know, and, you know, he's a great kid. Really, really great guy. Really great guy. But I could see him just like sort of grabbing somebody and throwing him in the basket.
Yeah. And you're like cheering him on, like, yeah, man, exactly, that's my bouncer.
Yeah, there. You're my saving grace to get me out of this hoisting,
yeah,
position.
Yeah. Yes. And that's exactly what we needed. You know, looking back, we had sort of been trying to figure out, why did they just stare at this basket? We have no idea. The only thing we could come up with is, during the day, we had sort of experienced, you know, sometimes you go to put the basket down. If it's like a wet deck, a wet steel deck, you get an arc of electricity, right? Sometimes from the basket down so the only thing we can think of is maybe the basket arced.
It freaked him out a little bit.
Freaked him out.
Getting electrocuted, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to get in the basket either if I just saw it, you know, discharge the static through the basket. Yeah,
that's or maybe they're watching your hover and they're like, yeah, I ain't going in that thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like,
bro, they sent JV out this time.
Yeah.
Tim, if you're listening, I just poured myself a little Four Roses bourbon, so cheers, brother.
Okay, you just said a little Four Roses bourbon, dude. That is a big glass.
That was an Uncle Rob pour.
I saw Uncle Rob. I was like, when is he going to stop pouring?
I feel like he's on my level. Anyways.
I could see that little, and I could raise you about a half of that.
My man.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I'm just not there yet.
You're not my favorite 60 pilot.
Okay. Didn't take much.
Nope.
So that's the only thing we could think happened was the arcing. Otherwise, we have no idea why they just stood around. But, you know, at this point, like I said, we have a sense of urgency to get this done. And so Aaron got them in, and then it became real smooth, up and down, up and down, up and down. And then Dave would call out the sets, you know, okay, here comes some more waves, and I'd move off the boat. And typically, you know, during earlier in the day, I would just have to move left, you know, maybe 100 feet or something like that, let the boat move, then it would settle down. And then I would just slide right, you know, I wouldn't have to climb or descend. I would just slide right back into position. It was really pretty easy to do that. I got in the hang of doing that. Yeah. So it became somewhat routine.
Nice.
And then later that night, as the tail was getting closer, so the bow, what we think happened was that once it ran aground, the bow now pointing into the seas, the bow started sliding, started drifting to the right, drifting to starboard, right? So now instead of the waves breaking right on the bow, now they're breaking a little at an angle to the bow, okay? And the bow is sort of slowly dragging right towards the shoreline. That's what we think happens.
Okay.
As it's doing that, we're trying to maintain our position into the wind line, because if you even with the 60, if you turn 5-10 degrees out of the wind line and 60
with that
knots
amount
of wind,
yeah,
you know, it's really uncomfortable. So as we're turning with the wind line, the tail is getting really close to the cranes and the center line of the ship.
It's uncomfortable.
Very uncomfortable. Yep. 100% do not recommend. So this is adding to the sense of urgency, because Brian is very, you know, he's watching the tail and he's getting concerned about the proximity. And he's telling me, you know, he's reminding me often about how close we are.
And as the flying pilot, when you start hearing that stuff, you tense up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep. And I was definitely tensing up.
Yep. Changes the like volume changes of your flight mech, and you're like, ooh, yeah.
I'm glad you told me, but if you didn't, I might be a little calmer. But also glad to know that.
Only tell me when it's really, really bad.
Yeah. Right.
So many things.
So in the 60, the 60 is a great aircraft, but one of the interesting things about it is, you know, we have a rear view mirror, right?
Yeah.
So you look in the rear view mirror, the tail is 40 plus feet behind you, right? So
that is pretty sweet.
It's a long way back there, right? So you got to keep that in mind. You know, every time you do a pedal turn or any time you do anything, you always got to, you know, typically in a helicopter, you're going to, that's a long way back. Yeah. You got to remember that thing's back there, right? So we're getting closer to those cranes on the center line of the ship. And Brian's, you know, he's doing his hoisting and stuff. He's constantly telling me about the cranes, like, hey, you're getting too close, or, you know, he's giving me conning commands, trying to keep that keep us away from those. And Dave's calling out the swells, okay, back off, you know, so I'd move off the ship, then I'd move back in, take one or two more people, I have to move off. And this time though, because the bow was pitching up more, because the swells were rising in the break zone, so the bow was rising even more. So what, instead of just sliding left and sliding right to come off the boat and let the swells go through, I was coming to come up and left,
okay,
and then down and right. Mm-hmm. So now I had this.
What would you say your pucker factor is, like in your scale of like your Coast Guard aviation career, like where were you right now in that spectrum?
Oh, I was pretty high.
Okay.
Yeah. I was pretty high. Yeah.
I mean, you talk about it pretty calmly now, so I'm just trying to project like
that's some feeling puckered right now.
That's 20 years of beer and, yeah, and whiskey.
That's also, yeah.
And sort of dissecting it.
That's the Voodoo Ranger talking.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, that's a good question. I was really high in the pucker factor.
Yeah.
This was definitely the most challenging situation I had ever been in up to that point in my career.
Okay.
And I'd had some more difficult or more high pucker factor after that.
Yeah.
But up until that point, you know, that was like the biggest.
Yeah.
So, but, you know,
I don't want to hear about the stories where you have a higher pucker factor after.
Well, yes. I think we're about to hear in about 20 minutes.
Especially in a Falcon.
No, no. So this episode, right, so this thing happening, you know, that sort of determines how I perceive other things later in my career, right?
Yes, 100%.
Right, so there is a lingering, throughout the rest of my Coast Guard career, there is a lingering, like, yeah, I've seen bad things, and I'm seeing, you know, but how I perceive them changes, right?
Yeah, so, tracking.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, so getting towards the last couple guys, I think we got number 7 in the basket, and Dave's calling out this. He sees this line of swells coming, and he's like, all right, these are some big waves. Once you get this guy off the deck, you have to come back and left, you know, back up and left. I'm like, roger that. He's like, you're going to need to really come up. I'm like, all right, that sounds good. You know, that's what I've been doing all day.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks for having me again. Right? Yeah. Cool story, bro.
So the guy, so number 7 comes off the deck, and he's like, all right, come back up and left, up. And you start, and I'm like, you know, I'm starting to come up and left, but I'm doing the same sort of gingerly.
Not trying to do it abruptly.
Yeah, I've got a guy on the hook and stuff. I'm not trying to swing him around. And, and then all of a sudden, he says up, 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 and I feel him come on the collective and start raising the collective. And I'm thinking to myself, you asshole.
Yeah,
you
that's
know
insulting.
Hard, you know, I'm looking down at the deck, so I'm not seeing anything. It's getting dark. The sodium lights of the ship are right in my eyes almost.
Yeah.
And they're illuminating the boat. So I don't really, even if I looked out the window, I wouldn't really be able to see anything. Because my eyes are, you know, sensitive now to the sodium light. But the bridge, you know, that part of the ship is lit up beautifully. And so that's my happy spot is mm-hmm. that hoist reference. Because it's so wonderfully lit and everything is dark.
Yeah.
So when he starts pulling up on the collective, I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to have such a hard time getting back into that one position because now everything's really moving and stuff like that. I had the aircraft, you know, sort of just right into the wind, keeping the tail away. And now you just screwed all that up. What I didn't realize was that the wave that he saw was really effing big, right?
Yeah.
And so all I saw at that point was the windshield just go white with water. It was like driving into a car wash.
Yeah.
You know, so the white is completely white with water. And at the time, I couldn't perceive what was going on, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like shock, right? You sort of, your mind is trying to catch up to what you're observing and trying to figure it out. And your mental cognition process usually takes about 5 to 7 seconds to work something out.
Right? Sometimes that's a good thing.
Well, yes.
A slow reaction.
Yeah, exactly, right? So I have the slow reaction, but, you know, Then I start hearing the low rotor warning light. I think I heard the tail rotor disconnect, not the tail rotor, the stabilizer disconnect. It's got an automatic function that, you know, so I hear that, you know, so I'm hearing bad things happen all at once. And I'm sensing that the NR is starting to get low, right? So I lower the collective a little bit and I try and start flying out of it. And then there was nothing. And we just went into the water.
Holy cow. So
1 second, I'm, you know, cussing Dave out because he's moved me so far out of position. The next moment, water is filling the cockpit.
Wow.
Dude, I can't, even just like listening to this, like my stomach is flipped upside down.
I knew this part of the story was coming and I feel my heart rate increasing.
I know.
Yeah, so you know, I've had 20 years of thinking through this, and I've worked this out quite a bit. And I've worked out the moments, you know, the seconds drag into several minutes.
Time dilation.
Time dilation is crazy, right? So I remember what I saw. I remember seeing blurry lights, but I also remember not really knowing what had happened.
Right.
You know, I know I'm underwater. I don't know how I got there.
Yeah.
Right. All of a sudden, I'm on, you know, what just happened?
Yeah.
I didn't see any of the descent into the water.
Because the last time you were like paying attention and not trying to react, you were how high?
Everything was great.
Yeah. You were what?
120 feet off the water.
That is a lot of out. So did you, for a second, were you like, was that a 120 foot wave?
No. I didn't even know.
Yeah.
I didn't know what happened.
Yeah.
I just, all of a sudden, I'm in the water.
Yeah.
That's all I knew was the windshield went white with water, and now I'm in the water.
Yeah.
And I am holding my breath.
Yeah.
And the water's cold on my face.
Yeah.
Right? That's all I knew.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until later that night when we were doing our SISM debrief in the bar at the Grand Aleutian.
Wow.
And I say, I told Tim, because Tim, as he mentioned, he saw the whole thing happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had no idea. And I'm like, I handed him a cocktail napkin with a pen, and I said, draw for me what you saw happen, because I have no idea what happened.
Yeah.
And so he drew it out on the napkin and actually showed me, like, graphically what had happened. That was the first I knew what had occurred.
Do you remember, like, in that moment, was your brain trying to figure out what had happened still, or did you just immediately go survival mode?
No, that's a great question. And I was, you know, I think your brain has to go through a process. I mentioned the 5 to 7 seconds. That was the process my brain had to go through to figure out what is going. So I needed to process what happened.
And so 5 to 7 seconds was 120 feet of descent.
No, I'm sorry. 5 to 7 seconds after we entered the water.
Yeah. Oh,
wow.
It took me that long to process, like, oh, you're in a bad place.
Yeah.
You need to do something about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because at first I was like, what is going, you know, sensory overload.
Yeah.
1 minute you're dry, you're at 120 feet. The next minute you're underwater and the water's cold.
Yeah. This is an aircraft wash
dark.
Gone wrong.
Yeah. And it's dark because it's night, right? So you
Holy
see
shit.
Some blurry lights. And so it's sensory overload.
Yeah.
Your brain goes into a hyper mode and you're just trying to, first you have to process, where am I? What just happened?
Yeah.
And before I can do anything about it.
Yeah.
Right?
What do I have to do next?
That cold water shock, like the immersion of that, like, oh my God, I couldn't imagine.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't actually that bad. At least I don't remember it being that bad. It may have been that bad, but I don't really remember that. We had a dry suit on, so 90% of your body is dry and warm and, you know, full of farts or whatever. But
full farts.
Many other things.
last ten, couple farts coming out of the
can confirm.
Right. So at that point, you know, it's I hate to say it, but it's almost every man for himself, right? Getting out of the aircraft,
Survival.
Right? So I'm in the front. And the first thing I do, once I realize, like, you need to get out of here, I reach for the door handle. And in the H60, it's kind of like, it's kind of where your butt is, but down about a foot or so like that.
Okay.
So I'm reaching down for the door handle, and I can't find it. I have gloves on my hands, but it doesn't matter, right? So people said, well, you know, maybe it's because you had gloves on your hands. You didn't feel it. No. My brain was so overloaded at this point. You know, so put it in computer terms, like, I've got a, you know, what is it, a 486 brain, you know, something circa 1985, right?
Yeah.
That's my processor speed.
Yeah.
And now all of my processing speed is being dedicated to figuring out what just happened, not necessarily how to get out, right?
Yeah.
So I'm a bear of very little brain to begin with, and now that brain is being overloaded by sensory inputs, and all of a sudden, you know, the panic factor was present. However, I was able to suppress it, but that took a lot of brain power to suppress it.
Yeah.
Right. So in that 5 to 7 seconds, it's a flight or fight response, right? So it's so you got to work through that. Am I going to fight or am I going to flight? So all this stuff is happening in my brain, at least when I'm going through this. So reaching for the door handle, I probably touched it.
Yeah.
I just did not feel it.
Weird.
Yeah.
Right.
Is just the regular handle, or is that the egress?
This is the regular handle of the door. Why the regular handle? Because that's the only one I ever use.
Yeah, 100%.
Again, my processing power is so minimal right now.
You got the spinny wheel of death going.
Exactly.
Yeah. You went in at a fatigued, drunken state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. Sort of like now.
Yeah. Well, now you're having to jumpstart
after
the brain.
3 days at Heli Expo.
Oh, gosh.
We're not going to talk about that raisin liver. Anyways.
Yeah. So I couldn't find the door handle, and I'm like, oh, crap. You need to buy more time.
Yeah.
So I remembered, fortunately, that I had a Heeds bottle. So I pull out the Heeds bottle. At the time, it wasn't the Seas bottle. It was the Heeds bottle. It was a bottle of compressed air that we had on our waist belt. Mm-hmm. And it had a lanyard that was attached to a cap. The cap went over the mouthpiece. Mm-hmm. And the lanyard went back to your belt. Mm-hmm. So what you had to do in order to get the cap off was you had to extend your arm fully so the lanyard would get tight and pull the cap off.
Okay.
And then you could just easily put the mouthpiece in your mouth.
Then or so they say.
Yeah. So then you had to blow out a full breath in order to clear the regulator. Yeah. And then you could start breathing normally. And so so I reached for that. I got the cap off. I tried to put the mouthpiece in my mouth, and I'm moving it around. And I could not get it in my mouth. Again, little processing power. I'm trying to figure out what the hell is going on. Why can't I do that? So I'm like, you got to get out of here. So I drop the bottle. I go back to the door handle. I look around for the door handle. I can't find it again. So I'm like, screw that. You need more time. So I go back to the belt. I trace my hand out the lanyard as we were trained, as the rescue swimmers trained us to do, right? So I sweat training really works.
Yeah.
So even in my little minimal capacity, I was at least able to remember my emergency procedures of egressing the aircraft.
Which is the point, right? So that when you're in that high stress situation, you don't have to use processing modules. You can it just happens.
React, right. You know? And even after this, I would always take, especially after this, I would always take sweat training very, very seriously, right? Not like diehard seriously, but, you know, they always offer you like the one ride. You could do...
They got rid of the super ride, by
the
way.
Yeah, they got rid of it. Yeah. You're in for three or four now, for sure. Yeah.
And, you know, and I was a proponent of getting rid of the super ride because I felt that in order to make it more ingrained in your brain, you had some repetition you needed to go through. And if you could just do it once, that's great because you're in a swimming pool and you can get through it easily because you already know it's coming. But if you're at that point where you've got 5% of processing power left, you need to count on that repetition, that muscle memory in order to make it work.
It's even funny, like you just talking about that, like I immediately transported to like Seeds where like you're waiting your turn and you're already like, okay, I'm gonna do this. Whereas like, it was just like, not only did you not have time to rehearse or think about it, but you didn't even know it was going.
You don't have the ditching.
Yeah, you know, and I do want to make this distinction. There is a distinct difference between ditching an aircraft and crashing an aircraft.
Yeah.
We crashed an aircraft, right? Ditching implies that you have, it's like
some controlled fashion.
Yeah, some controlled, some decision that happened to...
Mental preparation, however little it may be, there is some mental preparation for what's about to happen.
Unscheduled maintenance there.
So if you want to rely on having that built into your 5% of processing power, you really have to think through it often, right? Anyway, so I'll step back from that and say, so I went back to the bottle. Finally, you know, so this is the second time going back to the bottle. This is my third attempt on the bottle. Traced my hand back. And this time I took the bottle and I rubbed it around my face for like a second or two, just mushed it around in my face. And finally, I was able to feel the mouthpiece with my tongue. And so I stuck it in, you know, and then blew out. And then I was able to start breathing.
What was the sense of relief when you did that?
Huge. It was like... I was not panicked, but I was getting to the point where I was like, it's almost time to start panicking, you know, like you got to do something. And I fought the urge, you know, there was a huge urge to release the belt. There was a huge urge to just, you know.
You're looking for something.
Yeah, exactly. Anything to give me an advantage, right?
Yeah.
And I fought those urges because that's what the rescue swimmers told me to do. Yeah. Fight the urge. They gave me a procedure. They made me learn it. Wait till all motion had stopped. You know, I did that. Check. Okay. You know, find a reference point, check, okay, you know, undo your harness, you know, hold on to your reference point, undo your harness, you know, all those things, like, you know, find your emergency egress. That was the only thing I couldn't do was find my actual exit.
Yeah.
Right.
Not for lack of will.
Right. But I knew that I needed the air. So, and this was another thing too. I don't know if it's built into the checklist now, but so in my mind, I'm going through that checklist and I'm actually able to sort of get through it, right? But nowhere in the checklist was there something that said Heeds bottle. You know, so that actually, again, 5% of the time, you know, 5% processing power. I'm like, when am I supposed to put the Heeds bottle
on? You're like, wait, hold, jettison, cord, harness, egress, inflate.
So Was that a clean breath of air that you got?
Oh, no, it was not.
A little dirty.
But it was the best breath of air you've ever had.
It was a little dirty. It was a lot like this. Yeah. Yes. A little dirty.
But enough to keep
you. A little sediment. Yeah, some oil. Yeah. Some oil, some jet fuel in it. Yep. Some seawater. Yeah, there was a little bit of all of that in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a nice breath, right? And so I thought that once I got the breath, you know, everything sort of just clarified a lot in my brain. And I reached for the door handle, found it right away, opened the door handle, and undid, you know, had my reference point, everything, all ready to go. And I just pulled myself through the open door.
Yeah. Was that relief also? Was that when you pulled yourself through the door?
Different
like,
gates
oh, man.
Of hope.
Yeah. 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 I knew. Well, so the aircraft hit the water.
Yeah.
And in a relatively gentle fashion, the only thing I can think is that it landed on the backside of a wave.
Mm-hmm.
But of course it immediately rolled over. Yep. So we felt the sensation of the aircraft rolling over. And that's when I waited for motion to stop and everything like yes. that. But what I felt my ears popping and I wasn't ready for that. Right. So the ears popping is telling me that the aircraft, there was some number that was going around in the 60 community for a while that if the H-60 crashes in the water, it's going to sink at like 40 feet a second or, you know, some crazy number. Right, so I'm here, I'm feeling my ears pop, and I'm like, I am sinking to the bottom.
Yeah. 14
I
have no, feet, 28 yeah. feet, yeah, 36 feet.
Yeah, and I have no idea how far down I am because it's dark. Yeah. Aircraft's upside down. I can't see any light whatsoever.
Yeah.
So when I finally got through, I was expecting a long swim to the surface. Yeah. But it was like, boop. I was like right at the surface.
Did you inflate to go up, or do you swim to the top? Or you didn't even have to?
No, just the buoyancy of the dry suit just pulled me to the top. Yeah. Which, you know, that's another thing too, right? So I really value the guidance by the swimmer shop and the, you know, holding on to reference points and stuff. It's definitely important when you have a dry suit with some buoyancy attached to it, right? Yep. So you can very easily, if you do it wrong, you can very easily find yourself pinned to the
bottom, but the top.
Yeah, right, right. And then, you know, who knows what happens then, right? So I definitely appreciated the guidance. Make sure you do hand over hand reference point. Yeah. Never let go of reference point and stuff like that. Very good. Very good guidance.
Yeah.
So I got up and there was already one guy getting hoisted up into the helicopter. I think that was Dave, if I'm not mistaken. Then Brian was next and then I was third.
Ugh, damn, I'm late to the party.
Yeah. So I don't know really how long I was underwater. I have no idea. I think Tim estimated, like, he's the only one that has like a good estimation, and that's about 2 minutes. So.
Wow.
I couldn't hold my breath.
That number blows
right
my
now.
Mind for like multiple reasons. Like you go through the sweat chair, I feel like I'm out in what, 5 seconds?
Yeah, that's because you're expecting it. But
yeah,
like,
but 2 minutes, man, holy cow.
Again, a survival mode, like you detach a little bit, come to and.
Yeah, you know, the biggest, I learned this from a swimmer too, you know, you swallow, right? So you've heard this before, like when you start feeling your lungs burn, swallow. And that helps you sort of like regain.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, so I was doing that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, that's really all I remember was doing that a lot until I found the Heeds bottle. But the swimmers told me, like, I drained the Heeds bottle. I forget how much air was in it, maybe 30 seconds or something of air.
Wow.
I must have taken some big breaths. That's all I could say.
Imagine.
I feel like I'd go through 30 seconds
I feel
real
like
fast.
It'd be one breath and you just see the dial go like that.
Yeah, well, I was once I got the Heeds bottle in my mouth, it was probably only 5 or 10 seconds until I got to the surface. So I must have been, like, gulping air.
Yeah.
For that time. So yeah, I got up and the rest of the story is really Tim's, because at that point I'm kind of out of action, right? So take me to the Grand Aleutian Seafood Buffet.
What's the rest of your story though,
so,
following that?
So hold on. First, for folks who hadn't maybe tuned into Tim's podcast, what actually happened? What caused the aircraft to crash?
You know, so what I'll say is this. I'll say that about 2 or 3 weeks after the mishap happened, a email started circulating around Coast Guard Aviation. And that email contained a PowerPoint presentation of a ship in that ran aground outside of El Morro Castle in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And it shows this wave dynamic where the boat starts to sink, you know, and once it hits the bottom, the energy of the wave can no longer, you know, so the energy is constantly being displaced by a boat because the energy, the wave goes under the boat and lifts the boat up, and that dispels the energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. However, when the boat is on the surface, fully on the ground,
in a heavy boat for that matter,
the water can no longer, the energy of the water can no longer lift the boat up and dispel the energy. So it breaks like on a seawall.
Yeah.
So the water crashed on the bow of the boat, you know, a big breaking wave crashed on the bow, and it's just like a seawall at that point. So the energy has to go somewhere. It went up. So the mishap investigation sort of determined, I think, that the water went up about 105, 110, 115 feet, something like that. I know we were in about 100 foot above the water
line.
That's water.
That's not spray.
No, that's spray.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it crashed and went up.
Yeah.
Right, but so it's all white water.
This isn't thin spray. This is just like still like a...
It's a wall of water.
Yeah.
Yep. Also, the mishap investigation, they pulled all the engine data and stuff like that and give Sikorsky some credit here. At least the engine manufacturers, the engines did not flame out. I originally thought they flamed out. The engines did not flame out. They just drooped way down.
Yeah.
And they were actually coming back up when we entered the water.
I did not know that either.
Yep.
Yeah. Every time I was like, yeah, the engines flamed out. Very interesting. It was just like a...
That was something I learned in 2012, 2010, something like that. So many years after the event. And, you know, up until that point, I'd said, the engine flamed out, but apparently not.
So by the data points, how much do they factor? How much more time till they might have come back?
I don't even know.
Interesting.
But not that long, maybe 5 seconds
but
more.
But even like at that altitude, I mean, like.
Right. And so now you're dealing, you know, when the engine droop down, you're dealing with a low rotor. There's a lot of compounding
issues.
Even if
you'd have caught it, the next wave is right in front of you.
Yeah, exactly.
So a different way of like going in.
But yeah, I just throw that out there. Here we are at Heli Expo. There's probably a Sikorsky booth somewhere around here. Yeah. You know, I got to give them a little props. They make a good machine.
So
it's kind of like the dude that takes his shit out mudding. And that's like, that's a piece of shit. Like, well, we're using it and abusing it. That's just what we have to do
for
our business. And
right.
So my question is the internal schism over cocktails that happened afterwards. What was that like?
Can I interject? I'm glad you asked that question because, I just feel like that's where my mind goes to, especially when Tim talked about it. It's like, okay, you get in that helicopter, your mind's probably racing of, oh my God, I'm alive.
A 65.
And now it's like you land Now what?
Yeah, so the first thing that happened, you know, and I hate to use the word surreal because I think it's overused, but if I've ever had one surreal moment in my entire life, it was when we got off the 65 in Dutch Harbor, when they dropped us off. They were going back out to the case because Aaron Bean, our swimmer, and the captain of the ship, they were still on board the vessel.
Yeah.
All right, and Tim's story is amazing from there.
Yeah.
Right. For us, there were three of us. It was Brian Lickfield, myself, and Dave. We were dropped off in the snow at Dutch Harbor Airport. Tim said, go away. We need to get rolling.
You know what to do.
We have a pickup truck. We have a cell phone. And we're driving around Dutch Harbor in the snow in this pickup truck, the three of us.
What just happened?
Exactly.
Wow.
Like, what do we, you know,
Did you drive?
I think Dave drove.
Okay, yeah.
I'm pretty sure Dave drove. I think I had had enough at that point.
You had too much fatigue drink.
Right. So
So
here, you know, here's Coast Guard training for you, though. We knew that there's a mishap, right? So we had to do some shit about it, right? So we knew we were going to have to piss and bleed.
Yep.
We knew we were going to have to do all these things in order, you know, so we called the ops boss. We called back home, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, we're driving to the local hospital.
Yeah.
And we walk in the door and we say, hey, we were just in a helicopter crash. We know we're going to have to piss and bleed. You know, can we just take care of this?
We want to drink. Get us a
Exactly.
Samples.
Exactly.
We need this.
That's exactly. We just want to get the process going, right?
Oh,
and
smart.
They had no idea what to do with this.
Yeah.
So, but driving through Dutch Harbor, you know, now it's dark. It's snowing. There's snow on the ground.
Is this a quiet truck ride?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot like,
no music,
what the
just
hell?
Everybody's,
you know,
like,
Dave saying, I told you so. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh. Like, why'd you grab the collective?
Yeah, so the schism that happened at the Grand Aleutian later that night, Dave, Brian, and I had started drinking long before Tim even got home.
I'm so glad you got to do that.
Yeah, we had no
Cope
idea.
Early.
We had no idea what they were doing or where they were going or anything like that.
Yeah.
But sometime, you know, maybe 10 o'clock at night or something like that, they finally rolled in. They were closing the bar at the Grand Aleutian. We got the bartender to keep it open. We told them the story, what was going on. And
yeah.
And there was a lot of like...
Got to be understanding of that.
It was a lot of just kind of like, you know, just talking through it. It was a lot of somber, you know, the the H-65 flight crew, you had Rob Kornexel, Tim Eason, obviously. Tim was a good friend of mine. We actually went back. We were in the same OCS class together.
Oh, cool.
We were in flight school together. I knew his wife pretty well. We were stationed in Kodiak for the first time together.
Yeah.
So we had gone, we go way back, right? Yeah. So when I got out of the 65, I had no idea it was Tim up front.
Oh.
He had his door open, and I made the mistake of tapping him on the shoulder, and he turned at me, and I said, "Hey, Tim, thanks for the ride," or something along those lines. And he's like, "Get the hell out of
so
here."
So he mentioned that.
Yeah.
He mentioned that, and he mentioned that was kind of an emotional thing for him when he said thanks for the ride. And he's like, "I still got work to do."
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that was bad timing on my part. Yeah. My life is full of bad timing.
No, but I don't know. Like, I mean, what you just went through, like.
Yeah, right.
Again,
right.
You're trying to find some kind of, like, you know, I don't know, humor.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And you know, one thing I remember really that stands out in my mind is the, you know, and they talk about this in SISM. They talk about how it may not just be a memory of something, but anything can trigger memory. So a sight of something, but also smell is a very, very strong sense, right? So fast forward a couple years, I went out to do the talk out in Oahu at, I'm sorry, not Oahu, in Barbers Point. And I went to the Arizona Memorial, and there's still diesel fuel that's coming up in the Arizona Memorial in Pearl Harbor, right?
Yeah.
And I walked into the thing, and all of a sudden, I had this, like, flashback, you know? Like, all of a sudden, it was just the diesel smell, or the fuel, the bunker oil is really what it is. It's not diesel.
You're right back there.
I smelled the bunker oil, and I'm like, holy crap. It just snapped me. Yeah. You know, I didn't freak out or anything like that, thank God. But it wasn't, by that point, so much time had elapsed that it wasn't, like, a hard thing to go through, but... It took a number of years to not have to think about it, to not have memories of it, to not have dreams about it and stuff like that. One thing that really helped me was traveling around the Coast Guard. I've been to every air station except Sacramento. I've been to every Coast Guard air station talking about this several times in some cases. Some air stations I've been to like 5 or 6 times just to do this presentation. Sometimes I do it with Tim. Sometimes I do it with you know, other members of the crew. I've done it with Dave. I've done it with, Rob sort of, I've never done it with Rob. I've never done a conversation like that with Rob, but Greg Gibbons was always there, several times he was there. And so traveling around with these guys and talking through it has been extremely therapeutic.
Yeah. So we actually did a podcast while we were here with Captain Dale talking about PTSD and how you don't know the timing of how something may affect you or how it may affect you. And it may be minor and it may be large. Looking back on that experience, you get back to the Aleutian. How do you guys think you handled that? How did Tim and his crew handle meeting you guys, knowing that you guys are good buddies, knowing that they dropped you off and left you to go back to do the King's business? Like, what was good, and like, what would you do differently? You know,
I wouldn't do anything differently.
Okay.
Oh man, look at
that's
this.
That's a glass of bourbon being handed over to our.
I appreciate that. Yeah, so we're at that part of the conversation where we've escalated. We've escalated dramatically.
That's what happens. So.
I don't think there's a thing you could or should have done differently.
Yeah.
Because like everything, like there's no way you would not dissect that since the day it happened.
Yeah.
But you can't not know that. Like you did what came naturally to you. About the best thing is like somebody can hear some of this. And take parts and pieces if they're...
Which, I'm a good example of that, but I'll get in that, like, when we talk about, when we're wrapping up, but...
No, like,
We did a SISM, an actual SISM session. We had SISM trained coordinators and stuff, and they were trying to do their job more than anything else, but this was several days later, because we were stuck out in the Aleutian Islands, you know, so... Mm-hmm. It took us a couple days just to get back to Kodiak, back to our families and everything like that. And by that point, I think the most effective schism had already occurred.
Yes.
That was the drinking in the bar afterwards, talking through it as a group and stuff like that. So when we had the schism session a couple days later, the formal schism session that we were forced to go to, right? The command made us go. And the coordinator or the person that was trying to give us the SISM session and work through stuff, they started crying, and that didn't really you know, at that point we were kind of like this, you know, we've told the story now like 30 times each, right?
So that's probably exhausting.
Yeah, right. So at some point you're like, is the story for us or is it for you? Yeah. You know, like,
but it's for everybody.
It's for everybody, like, because that's exactly the point I was driving at. When you have a mishap like that, it doesn't just affect the flight crew. It affects the whole community. Yeah. And right.
A quick question, and I wasn't there for Tim's part of it. Did he know it was you on that aircraft?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I think he did you tapped him on the shoulder and he realized it was you. Well, that was the part of the story that he was telling.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it may have been.
So SISM is great. I think it's for, I think it's a great look just in case if anything was missed, in case somebody's having a hard problem, to bring it to medical professionals. I think it's a great thing to share it to the fleet. But I think the unofficial in-house crew SISM is super important. And I hope folks listening to this podcast who are going through their first pilot, advanced SAR, who are soon going to be aircraft commanders, take away, obviously the egress thing is massively important, but after a big case, kind of all go away and then you come back, you need to make sure your crew is okay. You need to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, even as a first pilot, it's fine. You don't have to be the aircraft commander, but make sure the debrief is done inside the crew and everybody's good and it's your responsibility. You know, and this can also fall on air crew as well, flight mechs and rescue swimmers. Your crew is in good shape.
Yeah. I'm going to throw out an idea here, and it's kind of like you talked about, like, bar SISM. You don't necessarily have to be drinking.
No,
it's
no,
the
you
intimate
don't.
Setting.
Right.
Like, when I think of, like, the official SISM you talked about, that's actually, like, this showroom floor we're sitting on, bright lights. It feels very operation room. Like, it's hard to be natural. Like, when you're with the people that almost a trauma bond or that have shared something, like, that's where you're more comfortable probably letting it out and opening up.
Yeah.
It's the more official ones, and I know it's what the service can provide, but you can't, like, because you're, like, that's when, like, your ego comes into, like, well, I still want to fly. I want to do this. Like, nothing has rocked me, which it has. And you pack that into a box, but you don't. You put a time lock on that, but you don't get to determine when that box comes unpacked.
You're right. That's exactly right. I don't want to downplay the Coast Guard SISM program.
No, this is the best it can be.
Yeah,
officially.
This is back in 2004, but it's not a one size fits all, right?
No, it's
and they do the at that time it was sort of in its infancy. Mm-hmm. They were still trying to create it. Really, they were trying to create facilitators and all those types of things. And somebody that's minimally trained, you know, at the time to be a facilitator, they, you know, in a small unit, Kodiak was not really a small unit, but in a small community, a small unit, everybody goes through a level of stress over a mishap. Yeah. And so very certainly, we're all human, regardless of who that facilitator is. They are projecting a lot of the stuff you're telling them. They're projecting it in their own mind for themselves too, right? So you're scaring the crap out of them because something just happened to you. You know, yesterday we were sharing a beer in the wardroom, and today I've crashed.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fortunate enough to make it out, but the same thing can happen to you tomorrow.
I don't know how to make you better. I'm trying to connect to help you, but it's like, where do you bridge that?
It's really difficult. And I don't want to downplay the importance of SISM at all.
No, it's great.
It's just that we found a method to do that, I think, initially. Now, I will say this, that it wasn't complete, right? So it wasn't like we all walked away from that first initial SISM. It
doesn't need to be.
No, right. It wasn't like all of a sudden we're all better.
Yeah.
We all had different ways that we sort of, you know, responded over time to this. We all had some setbacks, probably, including myself, a number of them, you know. And it wasn't until I went to the headquarters, which was a therapeutic tour for me.
Yeah.
I got out of the cockpit for a little while. They made me go to Bethesda, to the Naval Hospital, to get actual therapy sessions.
Yeah.
So they gave me, they didn't have a path for me right away, but once I told them that I was having trouble, they sort of created a path for me to get back to flying. And I got back to flying 3 years after being at headquarters. So
that's good to hear.
To tie back into the PTSD like episode, like that, like it shouldn't take an accident. Like, pilots have problems. Like, those mishaps, that's like on the extreme end of catastrophic, especially walking away. But like anything, like we've gotten better, but there's still like a path to go with it.
So like I made the distinction earlier about the difference between ditching and crashing, right?
Yeah.
There's a difference between PTSD and a normal reaction to an abnormal situation.
Yeah. Yep.
And so when I went to the therapy, the naval therapist or psychologist, I went through NAMI a couple times. I was doing ink blot tests, all nine yards. Right, they wanted to make sure, absolutely sure, that I was good to go before I got back in the cockpit, right? And that I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
Right. So, but the therapist, ultimately, the guy that was sort of checking me out to go move on to the next step, he said, I don't think you have PTSD. I think you just have a normal reaction to an abnormal situation,
which,
right?
It's not just us. Probably all the way up through the FAA, there's a little archaic mindset that still has a lot of time to grow. To, like, we have damaged pilots that hide it, and they just, like, they continue on.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's normal. It's a normal reaction.
We've created
to an
a norm out of it.
Yeah.
And, I think, like you, as, like, an amazing story, is, like, you're still a good pilot, but you have to have that time to process and go through something, like, to come back very healthily. And I don't know, I'm glad you were able to get back in the cockpit.
Yeah, me too.
That
was just the first half of my career was behind me at that point. The second half career was just as great as the first half.
You flew Falcons, Broner alert, I hate we got rid of it. No, I mean...
You are the first helicopter guy that I've ever said, heard say anything good about the Falcon.
Oh, I think the Falcon's rad.
I'm like, that's sweet.
It was, back in the day, the going to a Falcon was all right, you're turning in your bro card if you go to the Falcon. Yeah. They always joked about holding hands in the cockpit, the whole nine yard. It was such a fun aircraft to fly.
Uncle Rob, sometimes I feel like I punched my Subway card. I'm still willing to go out and do the King's business, but I'm like, hey man, I've done some cool stuff, but also to fly that high and get burgers in Aspen or something, you gotta have a good deal.
Yeah. Right. And there's a lot of good deals in the Falcon. Actually, Morgan Roy, she was on a podcast not too long ago. She's up at ALC. Yeah. And she actually mentioned a SAR case that she and I were on. So there were a lot of good SAR cases in the Falcon. That was a aircraft that was a very good pilot's aircraft to fly, but you have operational challenges in that just like you do in a helicopter. They're just different challenges.
You can say the 65.
Yeah, helicopter. Any helicopter, really. I mean, hoisting is the operational challenge.
Yeah.
Dropping stuff in the middle of the night in a Falcon, didn't have NVGs, trying to drop to a moving light in the middle of the,
fast as they move to descent rates,
speed.
Yeah,
120, 130 knots, you're trying to drop a life raft or whatever, There are challenges in that aircraft as well, and that was a great point in my career, moving into the Falcon jet, flying with people like Morgan. She was an awesome, awesome pilot. I'm sure she still is,
what's funny is, I just got, teleported back. We might need to cut this out, but, it was, my first day at ATC. I'm, there for the 65T course, and there was, an all-hands, and we have to go to it. And I'm in the bathroom. I'm at the urinal, and some guy walks up next to me, and he looks. He makes eye contact. He's like, "Don't worry, I'm not a Falcon pilot." I was like, dude, "What does that even mean?"
You're Lieutenant Junior Grade Ingram is like, "I'm just here to go to the bathroom."
Again, the same thing doesn't necessarily add to this, but when I'm downrange in Afghanistan, free coffee shop, shitty books. I pick one out one day. It's Shadows of War or something, some Dean Koontz book, and I'm reading it, and it's like. Some cool story, and they have a Coast Guard aircraft in the book, and it's a Falcon. It talks about it doing a low pass that scares the enemy, and I was like, holy shit, Coast Guard's cool. As on this Army pilot reading in Afghanistan. Then I'm like,
sweet
nice
accent, by the way. I don't know what that was.
That was Uncle Rob's bro accent.
Okay.
Bro accent. Get some gnar. Shred of the gnar.
Before we go way too off, I just want to thank you, Doug, for coming on the podcast. We did this episode with Tim Eason. I was hanging on every single word. This was exactly the same.
I appreciate that.
I know this is probably bad to say. It was so entertaining.
In
the best way possible.
Riveting.
So the plug that I was going to make is before I met you, right as I was getting in the Coast Guard, I've heard of this, the Selendang IU case. And somebody once, right before I did my first swim sweat, they were like, you need to take this seriously. You go to the cage once a year. You need to go for all of the rides. you need to take your time. You need to, you know, make sure the seize bottle gets in. You need to hold a reference point. You need to safely exit the simulator, right? And they told me the story, and I was like, cool, done. And ever since then, it's like every year, swim sweat comes up. I take it seriously. I sit in the aircraft. I go for the, you know, the door handle, the emergency egress, touch my seize bottle, my webbing cutter, and my mic boom.
That's awesome.
And it's just like one of those things that, you know, it, and it's because of the stories that, you know, you traveled each and every unit telling these stories, and all of the instructors that I've had have shared that with me. So thank you for that.
And I think like a legacy, like we all want to be known for a legacy. Not that it's like you wanted the water. It's like you've trained generations of pilots to like know, like, how do we survive? It's like somebody that came away from an accident that shared a story and we're all better for it. Like so much.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I'm not going to recite the podcast number or anything like that, but at one point there was a conversation about famous versus infamous, right?
Oh, we know this. Yes.
Right?
Let's call him out on it.
Right. So my legacy really is infamy more than famous, right? But hold on a second. So what I wanted to, you know, what I wanted to say is, you know, your professional reputation is everything. And I know the next question you guys are going to ask is, well, would you leave anybody with any kind of advice that you've gotten or whatever? You know, I know that's
coming. And I know you're going to.
What a great listener, because he knows. And I know it's going to be a good one. Right, so I'm excited.
So, you know, you're not always going to do everything right. Right. So turn infamy into fame. Right. Yeah. So the best thing I could do for my career, my professional reputation, is turn this into something positive.
Yeah.
And Tim and I and Greg and Dave, over the years and, you know, now 2 decades going on, we've done our best to turn this into an educational experience. So we do a complete case study of the whole mishap and everything that happened, because we want this to, at first we just told the story and it was a freak show, right? Because everybody just wanted to go see the freaks, right? And we told the story and everybody just, you know, they clapped and said, you know, that sucks. Do you have any lessons learned? Do you have anything you could share with us, like stuff you learned? And at first I was like, no, don't be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, that was it.
Right.
But over years of thinking through all of the case study and actually developing it into a ORM case study, we started learning. Like, I started becoming more mature with that.
Yeah.
And I started trying to take, you know, infamy and turning it into something different.
Yeah.
Which was, I'm not just the freak. Now I can actually offer something of value in my experience.
As you're talking about, like, all the communication issues you had in 2004, I think about, like, what we get frustrated with now. I'm like, shit, is it technology? Is it money? Like, because we get frustrated with it, and it's first world problems, but that back then, that was like even much more deteriorated.
Yeah, right.
I think you guys did actually amazing considering, like, you know, what was available at the time. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm gonna jump in, Doug. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you so much.
You're a fantastic storyteller.
Sincere.
And just because you've told it many times doesn't make it easier. Thanks for being vulnerable.
Yeah, no problem.
There are very few times where I'm like emotionally connected to like a story, and this is one of those. Like, I feel emotional right now just saying that.
No problem.
Thank you, man.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
Can I make a plug?
Yes.
Of course. No, you cannot.
Nope. No. Thank you.
Floor is yours.
Yeah. Of course.
All right. So here's my plug. Part of my job is developing air crew. We fly sensors now on helicopters. You know, this is basically a page out of the Coast Guard playbook, right? We've been doing that in the Coast Guard for years, putting air crew members in the back of aircraft, flying around, giving them access to sensors and stuff like that. We give them lots of training. Well, my company, we fly utility. We're flying power lines inspections, and we just started doing it. So we're creating, I'm sort of the Stano/training guy, and I'm helping develop an air crew training syllabus. And when you start doing that from scratch, and I call ATC Mobile every once in a while and say, hey, can you send me a syllabus? You know, like, because the Coast Guard, as far as I'm concerned, is the model that I want to emulate, right? And I've got people in my company that agree with that. I fly with Bill Field, who is the Falcon guy that I replaced, you know, and stuff like that. And he's always asking me, hey, can you get a hold of ATC's mishap plan, you know, stuff like that, right? So we return back to the Coast Guard because we hold it as the gold standard. So As part of this development of the air crew training program, one of the things I've had to do is create a flying in the wired environment training program. So that's one of those things is you, when you see it, you'll be like, how have I gone so long as a helicopter pilot without knowing this stuff? You know, so they don't teach it at flight school, right? Or you're given very little information. Yeah. They say, you know, when you're looking for power lines, you're, there's a good chance you're not going to see it.
Yeah, cross at the stanchion. That's the only thing that I know.
Right. There's so much more to that. Here at HAI, well, now VAI or whatever, on Sundays, usually Sundays, and they do a, there's a company called UAS, and they provide a flying in the hazard and wire environment course. Absolutely recommend it. It's about an 8-hour course, and you're like, how can you fill 8 hours? Oh, they fill it, and it will shock you how much you don't know about it. So what I did a couple years ago is I went down to ATC. I sort of solicited myself, and I said, I can help you start your own flying in the wired environment training course if you want, something for ATC. So I gave a presentation and showed the gave training to. It's not just a pilot course. It's an air crew course. So it involves rescue swimmer. It should involve flight mech and stuff like that. It's something I've become very passionate about because it was something that we needed to know a long time ago. And a lot of people get killed by wires. Yeah. We had, what was it, the 6017? Is that it?
Yes.
LaPush?
Yes.
LaPush? Yeah. They ran into the wire out in Oregon or whatever. Yeah. Or Washington. Washington, Oregon.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's affected us, but we haven't really done anything as a community about it, right? So I'm passionate about that. Whether you create your own training or whether you go to UAS, learn how to create your own training. I would even volunteer my time to help you create training for it. I'm very passionate about it. It'll open your eyes to hazard awareness. It's like super hazard awareness.
Yeah, that's a fantastic plug. I agree 100%. Yeah. So,
you know, in my mind, I think about New Orleans, right? Obviously, Hurricane Katrina, you see helicopters hovering around power lines, all this stuff,
that Mississippi
right?
So, river.
Yeah, exactly. Anywhere.
Yeah.
Any city, anywhere, you know, even offshore, you know, LaPush.
Now,
they were flying in a channel, and it was.
I'll say, like, big things, like, you know, your own AOR, you know that it's, you're ferrying an aircraft. Mm-hmm. You're going place, like, on, like, out of the norm locations.
Right.
Yeah.
That's where it's going to get you. And like sometimes, and like not to steal your thunder, but going along with that, coming out of Eagle, Colorado, off a trip, ATC told us to stay down at 500 feet coming through a pass for their corridor, their approach corridor. And don't know the area. See a charted map. Some of the pilots gave us an idea. And as we cleared via the iPad, like knowing we're out of their airspace, hey, let's just come up a little bit and ride this one ridge line. And as we came out of their airspace and they finally cleared us, huge monster set of wires that the people there did not really convey, and we were on the correct side of the ridge line. I was like, holy shit, had we stayed at that altitude? And like, again, former Army pilot, a VY airspeed, I'm like, I didn't want to go fast, and that would have caught me by very much surprise.
Yeah, so they say, and you can actually find information online, there's video courses and stuff like that, but HAI actually produced with the FAA in conjunction with this company UAS, they produced a 20-minute long video about flying in the wire environment. Yeah. You can download that on YouTube. I mean, download, that's such a an old guy term, isn't it?
Still counts.
Okay, it still counts. Anyway, so you can go watch that, and it's eye-opening, but you know what they say is there's 60% of the pilot, you know, out of 100% of the people that survive wire strike accidents, 60% did not see the wire they hit. So there's lessons to be learned there.
Yeah.
And then 40% actually hit the wires they knew were there.
Yeah.
And why. So there's a whole another line of thinking there, right? So it's a compound problem. And that, like I said, plug for myself, I will be happy to help you guys create something.
That is
free of charge.
That is a fantastic plug. We won't count that as the next question that I'm sure you're expecting that we're going to ask, that I'm actually very excited to hear. Advice. For either life advice or future aviators, current aviators, experienced aviators. Like, I'm just going to sit back and relax.
Somewhere
between
be a good pilot and a decent officer.
Yeah.
And a human.
Yeah.
Decent human, not just a human.
Rob, we didn't ask you. We asked Doug. Yeah.
No, that's what I meant.
Kenny, you got any other injections there? Answer that question.
No.
Any riders? No. Okay. So what I'll say is I already mentioned something about your professional reputation, right? So protect your professional reputation. It's everything inside the Coast Guard, outside the Coast Guard. Your professional reputation really matters. So protect that. Do what you can to protect that. I had definitely a hiccup in my professional career. And although I was not conscious about my professional reputation, I had other things to worry about. I feel like I've tried to do my best to turn around a bad thing and make it a positive, right? But professional reputation, you know it because you guys are at ATC. You hear about pilots. You know their reputation before they show up. You know who they are to a certain degree, right? So protect that. Study, stay in the books, be a good pilot, do your best at your collaterals. Those types of things just help you in general. What I've realized coming out of the Coast Guard is a lot of the collaterals in business aviation, right? So I'm in business. I'm not in the airlines. And so it's a different life in the airlines. But my collaterals in the Coast Guard have really helped me professionally in the civilian sector as well, right? So all this crap that I hated doing in the Coast Guard, I'm actually like, yeah, I can do that. I know how to do that. And I can look really good. My professional reputation is pretty good because the Coast Guard trained me how to be a PAO or trained me to be a Stano and stuff. And so those things sort of come naturally to me at this point. So those are all good things. And you can hate on them while you're doing them because it takes you away from flying.
I do hate on them a lot.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Universally.
But you know what happened to me is I got out of the Coast Guard. I went into a civilian organization. I flew the line. I flew as a line pilot in the Gulfstream as well as the helicopter for about a year. And I started getting bored with that.
You just get the reset.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just like, I feel better. I feel like refreshed. Now I need to start looking for problems and trying to figure out how to solve them. Yeah. Whether or not they want me to, that's another question, right? Yeah. But I'm finding problems, yeah. Right? Don't just complain about things. Actually offer a solution as well, right?
Yeah. But that's the difference between an ask or a task.
Exactly, right. There you go. And so so what I would ultimately say, though, you know, to answer the question, here we are, you know, 20 minutes later. To answer the question, what I would say is you guys often on the podcast talk about humility, stay humble, that kind of thing, which is great advice. One thing that I remember, it sticks in my mind very well. I came back from a SAR case when I was at Clearwater, and I remember doing, you know, this is before before smartphones existed and stuff, but I remember somebody took a picture of me standing in front of some survivors out on the ramp after we landed at Clearwater, and I was kind of like real smiling, stuff like that. And you look at the picture, those survivors are absolutely miserable.
It's the worst day of their life.
It is the worst day of their life.
Yep.
And you were sitting there like smiles and giggles because you're all proud of yourself for pulling them out of the water. And it is absolutely, you could tell just by looking their face, there's dread in their eyes.
Or making
right?
them take pictures.
Right.
Sometimes.
So when I think of stay humble, what I think of is, you know, don't exploit somebody's worst day of their life.
RPAO plug doesn't have to be at their expense.
Yeah. Right, right. And
that's not our purpose.
The Coast Guard thrives on PAO, right? Mm-hmm. We need that for money in Congress, all sorts of things. We really need that. And it's okay to be proud of ourselves for doing stuff. Just be cognizant of the survivors when you're doing that, because it could be, you know, they could have lost their entire life in that sailboat that just sank. That could have been their entire life.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's it. That's all I got.
Man, I think if we go another 6 minutes, we could break Tim Eason's record.
I don't want to do
keep
that.
It rolling.
The road is a roadcaster.
I don't want to be in that category.
The roadcaster is so bad.
The roadcaster is smoking right now.
Dude, I can smell that little electrical burn.
Doug, one of the most epic podcasts.
Yeah.
Being a part of this and being able to listen to it, absolutely enthralling. Thank you so much. Yeah. Great to run into you.
Yeah, good running
great
you.
Great human being.
I don't know about that.
Just fantastic to talk to.
You don't know my dark side.
Oh, but if I give you some more bourbon, I'll probably find out.
Yes,
you
will. He's a darker one. Anyways. Yeah.
My dark side came out at the Airbus party last night.
We were all there for that. I think
listeners,
all of ours did.
Hope you like this episode as much as we did. This was incredible. Thank you, Doug.
Hey, no problem. Hey, thanks,
cheers.
Guys.
See ya.
Fly safe.
We're out.
We say goodbye, but never let go.